From WHQR Public Media in Wilmington, North Carolina, this is Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. The first day of summer is almost upon us, but for many kids in the North Carolina public school system, summer vacation started early. In April, state education officials declared elementary school students would not receive a final grade. Middle school students would receive a pass or withdraw designation. And high school students get to choose how their grade appears on their transcript, either a numeric grade as of March 13th or a pass withdraw mark. The decision is meant to ensure that at-risk students are not unfairly penalized while schools are closed and there is only remote learning due to COVID-19 restrictions. The Department of Public Instruction says it this way: it is the intention of this policy to ensure no students receive a failing grade and that students' grades as of March 13th serve as a minimum or a hold harmless point. Today, we'll explore some of the early outcomes emerging from this policy with three new Hanover County Public School teachers, but we'll also explore how teachers tasked suddenly with creating an effective remote learning curriculum, how they're doing, what they've learned from the last 3 months, what's working, what's not, and where the gaps are in the system that need to be addressed. But there is another issue that is dominating this country's collective psyche and its streets: the death of George Floyd in Minneapolis at the hands of a former police officer. We've seen protests in cities across the country and right here in downtown Wilmington. So today, we'll also find out how our public school teachers would address this issue with their students, given the opportunity. Joining me now, Delia Herman. She is a teacher at Hoggard High School in Wilmington. Delia, welcome to Coastline.
Thank you for having me.
Tim Jarman is a teacher at Ashley High School. Tim Jarman, welcome.
Thank you.
And Lena Vardam is an instructional coach and a teacher at Williston Middle School. Welcome, Lena Vardam.
Hi, thank you.
And we're inviting you to join the conversation. How have your kids handled learning from home? Did you give them a pass and tell them to start summer recess early? Why or why not? Have you communicated with your child's teachers? You can tell us about it during the live Wednesday discussion via email at coastline@whqr.org. And of course, I'm still broadcasting from a home studio, so we're not taking phone calls. But again, that email address for the live Wednesday discussion is coastline@whqr.org. Lena Vardam, you have worked on reducing bias-based bullying in school. You've also worked on educating students about the only recorded coup d'etat in American history, which took place in Wilmington, North Carolina in 1898. So you have some experience talking about racial bias in a learning environment. Given the opportunity, how would you address the death of George Floyd in a classroom?
Well, thank you so much for asking. I think that's really important. I think that if we were in the classroom, we would certainly be addressing this. Students would ask questions, and it would be incumbent upon us to answer and to help students make sense of what we see going on in the world today. And I'd like to start by saying that I think that some people may think this is a political issue. I would respectfully disagree. I believe this is a moral issue. In the classroom with students, if I were to approach this topic, I would start from the basis that racism is wrong. And that as we talk about the protests that we've seen, the killings that we've seen, we have to think about each other. We have to set norms in our classrooms. We have to be respectful of each other. So that's where I would start in my own classroom. But I will say that there are lots of teachers who are approaching this issue even remotely. We're doing that at Williston. We're working on gauging student interest and figuring out what the students need from us. And what's been really beautiful actually about that is that our students have indicated that they want to listen and learn about what's happening, and they want to ask questions. And I think that's really wonderful. And it's a bright spot for me to see that that's the position that our students at Williston are coming from. I think if we were all listening a little bit more and asking more questions, we might be in a better position today.
What kinds of questions are you hearing from students at this point about it?
Well, at this point, I have not heard their specific questions. We are planning to have some Zoom discussions next week with our interested students. And so I haven't heard their specific questions yet. In our Zoom discussions, we're aiming for a space where students can share their thoughts and feelings, where they can be heard, and where they can also take in the thoughts and feelings of their peers, because I think that's something that is missing with students out of school right now.
And understanding that this is theoretical at this point because school has ended for right. this semester. But Tim Jarman, how would you approach this kind of conversation in your class? And maybe start by telling us what you teach and the kinds of students that you have.
Fantastic. I teach at Ashley High School. I teach primarily AP classes, specifically AP Language and Composition and AP Seminar. And in these courses, obviously I'm dealing with students who are juniors, seniors, and even sophomores sometimes, who know that going into the course, we'll be talking about sophisticated and controversial and challenging issues. With that being said, I approach all difficult conversations with my core values as a teacher. So my core values that I talk to the students about on the first day are effort, empathy, inquiry, and honesty. And I feel like my approach to this issue will start with those values. And with that all being said, I would start by doing something similar to what's already happening at Williston and listening to my students, seeing the questions they have, seeing how they're coming into this situation so that I could plan my instruction accordingly to meet their needs, because this is a moral issue. This is a human issue. This is not a political issue. And once again, just kind of use those values of effort, empathy, inquiry, and honesty to gauge what my students need and to build an approach from there that is predicated off of those four values as well. So that's it for me.
Thanks, Tim Jarman. Delia Herman, how would you approach it with your students if you had the opportunity?
Interesting question, because each class requires a different response. Sure. What Lena's students need at Williston is different from what some of my students need at Hoggard. I teach some classes that are entirely white students. Their response, my response, I should say, should not be the same as Lena's, is not going to be the same as Lena's response, probably. But I noticed that by the time the students get to high school, they already form their opinions. So I thought it was interesting. Lena said that her kids are asking questions. I wish my students would ask questions, because by the time they get to me, they already have their opinions formed. And you can tell what their opinions are based on usually what news sites their parents are using. So I've learned, because I used to be very bad at addressing these things in the classroom because I get a little bit emotional. I've learned to put all the questioning on my students and let them all figure it out for themselves.
So how, when you're dealing with students who feel like they have a pretty rock solid opinion, they know where they stand and there's nothing to learn on an issue, how do you open the door for them to think about it differently?
In a really good class, we'll have students on the other side challenging them, but sometimes I don't have that. So I have to ask. I will ask a question. If I try to tell them, it's not going to work. They're not going to respond as well as if I say something like, let's say my student referred to the protests as riots. Okay, well, why might some people refer to them as protests and some people refer to them as riots? Yeah. And just try to get them to look at the other perspective.
Tim Jarman.
Sure. I'm teaching a course where we're constantly investigating news sources. And, you know, one thing that I focus on with my students is understanding that even in something that's a work of nonfiction, that there's a narrative in place. And, you know, based off of the different political affiliations of the news source, you'll see a different narrative. And part of my job as a teacher is to refocus the narrative, or maybe change the narrative completely, and just bring it back to the why of an issue and start focusing on the source of an issue and build from there. Another thing as well, to kind of objectify these situations, is to talk about pattern recognition. You know, I tell students often that intelligence is largely defined as pattern recognition. And so then we'll kind of start our independent research, you know, looking for certain patterns. And obviously in this case that we're talking about in regards to George Floyd, that there is kind of a history. There are some patterns in place. And then we kind of start from that place of inquiry and curiosity. It's a way to kind of move past the political or the politicizing of the issue.
And it does look like educating kids about news sources and how to vet them is going to become a more and more important part of just education in 21st century America, but probably the world. Let's get to the challenges of remote learning for students. First of all, what did you see among the students in your classes once they found out that there would be no consequences if they just checked out? I guess that would have been late April that happened. And that means that you're going to have to answer that question when we come back from this break. You're listening to Coastline. We're taking a closer look at remote learning in North Carolina and New Hanover County since the governor's order to close schools. How did your children fare with remote learning? Tell us about it, or ask your own question of our three public school educators during the live Wednesday discussion by emailing us at coastline@whqr.org. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn for Coastline. Listening to Coastline, I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. Once North Carolina students learned they would not be penalized with a failing grade after March 13th, teachers have witnessed a broad variance in student accountability and engagement. Today, we're exploring what teachers have learned during the last couple of months as they've been forced to develop remote learning plans and execute them remotely. With us today, Tim Jarman, Ashley High School teacher, Delia Herman, Hoggard High School teacher, and Lena Varnum, Williston Middle School instructional coach and teacher. And they're answering your questions during the live Wednesday discussion. How are your kids doing in the coronavirus era? What's been good for them? What concerns do you have? You can send us an email during this live Wednesday discussion at coastline@whqr.org. And we're going to talk about how students reacted to learning that they wouldn't be penalized for checking out early. But first, Lena Varnum, you had something you wanted to add about how you would address kids who might be coming with a closed mind to a controversial issue or to a discussion of what happened with the death of George Floyd. So you want to tell us about
yes.
that.
Thank you. I just wanted to add that as a teacher talking about these issues, I would lean heavily on primary sources as well. I would go back to Martin Luther King Jr., his speech, The Other America. He says some really poignant things that address what's happening today. I would go to Malcolm X even. I would talk about violent versus nonviolent protest, and I would give students that historical underpinning so that they would have the tools to be able to form their own opinions.
Mm-hmm. Delia Herman.
I know we're supposed to be talking about distance learning, but I know this is something we're all passionate about. I want to add on to that because Tim said that he does a lot with talking about the narrative and whose voices are we centralizing in the narrative. And the majority of teachers are white. I think it's like 84% of teachers are white. So it's really important for us to check what we're teaching, because it's not our fault that we might be unintentionally pulling in texts that don't give a variety of viewpoints. So I think what Lena said is really important is who are the students reading? Whose voices are getting heard in the classroom? And I think Timothy would say the same thing. Our voices as white teachers isn't always the voice that needs to be heard.
That's true.
Yeah. And so Tim, how would you approach the fact that you're a white male and perhaps not coming with an experiential perspective?
For discussing these issues of race?
Yeah.
The first thing that I would have to do is just acknowledge the fact that I am a white male, that I do have certain privileges. And then I would follow my traditional course of action where, you know, focus on the students' needs, the concerns, and then, you know, build up curriculum and facilitate discussion based off those needs in a way that actually brings in divergent or diverse voices, but also, just like Lena said, bring in sources and curriculum that would provide the students with kind of the tools to frame it in its larger historical and social context, and not just looking at issues sometimes as issues in of themselves, but be able to frame them in a larger context so they can start recognizing certain patterns throughout history. And what that usually does is it makes it even a more powerful and imperative issue because students see that there's a legacy and that, you know, they're dealing with a sense of justice, they'll develop more of a sense of justice just based off of seeing that this is something that's been continued throughout past, but that it can have a role in addressing, understanding, or stopping. So thank you for that question.
Yeah. So let's look at student engagement since the Department of Public Instruction announced that students wouldn't be penalized for what happens after March 13th. Delia Herman, you're smiling. Were you surprised by what happened and what did happen in your class?
I think everybody can guess what happened in our classes. Once my students found out their grades didn't matter, a lot of them checked out, but not all of them. And I have to say, I was really impressed by the number of students who continued to do their work, even though they knew all their friends were checking out. So I was impressed. But at the same time, I remember what it was like to be a teenager. And I mean, I'm getting paid to sit at my computer every day. These students are not getting paid to sit at their computer every day, and they're 15. So can you really blame them?
So can you give us a rough percentage of the students who hung with it and the ones who left?
Depends on the class. So I had 2 honors level classes, and I would say by the end, I was having about 50% of them still turn in their work. And then I had a more advanced class. Students had applied to be in this pre-IB program, and I probably had about 90%.
What was it like for you, Lena?
For me, we struggled with student engagement, I would say, throughout, partly because of access. A lot of students struggled with being able to access the online curriculum, even though our school and our school system, I think, did the absolute best that we could in distributing devices to students and in trying to make sure that our students had internet access. Those in themselves were huge hurdles. After the announcement about grading happened, I would say certainly we had a drop off in participation. But like Delia said, I'm really impressed with the students who stuck with it and who continued to engage in our online lessons and really continued to learn for learning's sake. I think that's really important, and I really want to acknowledge all the students across the district who did that, who hung in there with us, because I know that as teachers, we were working really hard to try to make sure that students had access to quality curriculum.
And we're going to find out, hopefully in a few minutes, what some of those techniques you used were in this new environment that some people are now calling the new abnormal. But Tim Jarman, how did it go for you?
I mean, my students were incredulous. Really? Mr. Jarman, grades? You promised there's no like curveballs or like any other clause in this. They were kind of in shock and in a state of disbelief. Not to say that they weren't grateful, but I was teaching mostly AP courses. And so the students still had their AP exams and the opportunity to earn their college credit. So I've had a lot of buy-in through that. And even with my AP language course, I mean, all of my students, you know, did most of the additional review and the practice, and we had a 100% participation rate for our AP exam for AP language and composition, which was great. And it's not about me there. That's really just like Lana said, it's all about the students. And I found myself in awe in that sense. But also the entire thing, once they made it not about grades anymore, it was a real opportunity for teachers and students to kind of reframe the conversation and focus on using this as a learning opportunity. And I mean, virtual learning is called virtual learning. And even just in its name, there was a focus on students kind of taking control of their education and doing some learning for their own and kind of becoming empowered using these digital resources. And we saw a lot of that. I mean, you can imagine all the students who just completely tuned out and were done when they had their grade, but it's incredible to see how many students really use this as an opportunity to become empowered and do some learning on their own.
You're listening to Coastline. Today we're talking with three new Hanover County Public School educators who are faced with finding new ways to connect with students during the coronavirus era. With us today, Lena Varnum. She's an instructional coach and teacher at Williston Middle School. Tim Jarman, teacher at Ashley High School. And Delia Herman, a teacher at Hoggard High School. Have your kids dealt with remote learning? And what do you think is working? What concerns you? Tell us about it by sending an email during the live Wednesday discussion to coastline@whqr.org. I want to read this email from Grace. She writes, "At first, my 13-year-old daughter was excited to be home, as though she was on vacation. Then the reality set in that she would be away from all of her friends and her teachers. No more drama class, no more interaction. She's handled it well, but she's been sad on a few occasions. Thankfully," writes Grace, "she is a self-motivated student, but she struggled a bit with certain classes. This situation made me really concerned for students who aren't as self-motivated as she is." Grace says, "If I had been put in this situation at the age of 13, I do not think I would have handled it as well." And so that leads us to what is happening with those students. I mean, we know that there are students in AP classes and honors classes who just checked out, and a lot of those kids will probably be fine. Is that a fair assessment? But what about the kids who are not in those classes and who may not be fine? I mean, what's likely to happen to them, Lena Varnum?
I think that as educators, we are going to have to plan for those students, for how we address any gaps that they have next year. We're going to have to make sure that we are laser focused on making sure that all of our students can get up to speed. We also have to approach it with a lot of understanding and empathy. Students who didn't engage in remote learning, there are many reasons why, and lots of them are understandable reasons. We had middle school students who were babysitting their siblings while their parents continued to work outside of the home. We had students who didn't have access to devices or internet. And we have students who are already struggling academically, and the thought of having to work remotely felt really overwhelming for them.
Well, just going back to the devices issue, Lena Varnum, that was something that we in the public understood would be addressed. Every kid was going to get a computer. Did that happen? Where did it not happen?
I believe that it happened as much as families reached out to their students' schools and came to pick up the devices that they need. I do think that our school system did a good job of providing students with devices across the county.
Okay, Delia Herman.
So I agree. The county and the schools did their best to get devices to the students. My sister, Jane, teaches at Murray Middle School, and she said her school went around and delivered devices to people they couldn't get in touch with, but they encountered them with internet. So even though kids had laptops, some of them didn't have internet access. They didn't have enough hotspots to go around.
So
So then a kid doesn't just need the hardware. I really want to make sure we paint the picture accurately here. And Lena, you were actually going through a list of some of the environmental factors that a student might have to deal with at home that we just wouldn't think about. You know, especially those of us who work from home can go into an office and close the door and flip on the computer and we're there. So can you go back to what it might be like? You said some of these kids are babysitting their younger siblings. Some of them, what are some of the other circumstances that even if I was given a computer, I don't have a good internet or reliable internet. What else could impede my learning?
Well, one of the circumstances that we've heard about a lot in our school is when families have multiple children. If you have four children in your home and you have elementary and middle school and high school, and teachers are scheduling Zoom calls, and we had no way to collaborate with each other in terms of making sure that they weren't overlapping. The other problem is with internet. Again, if you have multiple people in a home who are all trying to access the internet, it's not always possible. And so in a lot of families, they were having to try to schedule their day. And this is when this child gets on the computer, and this is when this child gets on the computer. Because even if they did each have a device, the internet may not have been able to support everything that they were trying to do online.
And I want to read this email from Mary, who writes, do you have any tips for teachers with a wide variety of kids, those who want to learn or whose parents do, that's important, and plan to do the work, and those who check out? Is there anything, she asks, that can be done to incentivize the learners who feel underserved? She says, our teachers seem to give very, very little work in middle school, mostly at the directive of their principal. Would you suggest extra work for those who want it or will do it?
I guess I can go ahead and jump in. We received guidelines as far as how much work a student should receive or how much time a student should have to spend on their schoolwork each day. So in middle school, we were asked to provide no more than 30 minutes worth of work per class per day. And so it may not look like much, but again, we're trying to reach a wide variety of learners, and that made it difficult. One of the things that a lot of the teachers did at my school is that we did offer extra opportunities and extra work. For my class, I offered it in terms of enrichment, and those assignments were optional, but they were assignments that were really focused on critical thinking skills. I wanted those students to have a little something extra to push them if they had the time and, you know, both the literal and figurative bandwidth to handle it.
Now, the three of you took different approaches to the remote learning in terms of which tools you chose to use and how you chose to execute your lessons. Tim Jarman, you decided that you were going to use Zoom so that kids had to show up at a certain time to be part of a Zoom class?
Yeah. So our high school, we adapted a virtual learning schedule. I think it was actually the same one that was used at Hoggard. And so there were times in which you could have classes and there was like, you know, during a certain period in the day. What I did is I built out my curriculum on my class website, and where I had all the resources, I had the lesson plans, had the objectives, all of those things. And then I would just offer two different Zoom classes, one during the time of the actual scheduled class and one during a time of our scheduled office hours, to just briefly review the information posted on the website and then answer any questions that students had live about that, which was great because if students didn't have access or weren't able or comfortable doing Zoom calls, they could simply just follow the website and follow along from there. And so I kind of used Zooms as a way to just, you know, amplify my instruction or answer any questions that the students had, which was really great. And I had some, it was nice also to be connected to the students and to engage with chat over Zoom and, you know, it was really productive for me. But I could understand how it would be a massive challenge for lots of people to attend those meetings. And specifically for me, with high school students, most of my students have part-time jobs, a lot of them inside of grocery stores. And so we're talking about different kind of burdens or situations. A lot of my students were getting called into work, particularly as, you know, COVID escalated, there was a need for grocery store workers.
Yeah. And so I'm just curious, and this is a detail, but did you have trouble sometimes with students, Tim, appearing to join the class, but they wouldn't engage with video? And when you actually called on them, maybe they were there, maybe they weren't. Was that an issue for you? Or did those kids just not even show up to the Zoom class?
Those kids didn't even show up to the Zoom class. But, you know, that's something that was definitely on my mind quite often. And it's one of those things where, like, yeah, those students for the most part didn't show up. I didn't have any major issues with that because I wasn't requiring students to be on the Zoom. It was highly recommended. And so students who were there on their own volition, and they were trying to make it useful for themselves and for the rest of us.
So. Delia Herman, you specifically chose not to do Zoom classes. Can you explain why and what you're learning about that approach?
When this all first started happening, I could feel the anxiety building in my students as they were just not sure how their classes were going to run online. And I just kind of went and made a pro and con list in my head. Should I do the Zooms? I felt like a lot of the teachers were pushing to do Zoom. So I just kind of, I thought about it. What's the benefit? What's the cost? And I just didn't want to stress my students out by making them have to be online at a certain time. I felt like I could record myself giving the instruction, giving them important information. I use Screencast-O-Matic. So I screen shared the PowerPoint or Google Slides. I went through my annotations that I wanted them to see, and then I told them to keep going.
And so Delia, I'm going to get to the rest of this when we come back from this break. You're listening to Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. Today, three new Hanover County Public School educators are with us today. We're taking a close look at what they're learning about remote learning, its opportunities and its pitfalls, and the concerns they have about the upcoming academic year. Delia Herman is a Hoggard High School teacher. Tim Jarman teaches at Ashley High School. Lena Varnum is an instructional coach at Williston Middle. You can tell us about your experience by sending an email to coastline@whqr.org. We're coming up on the last segment, so just a few minutes left to get your question or comment in. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline. Listening to Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. Today, it's a look at what we're learning about remote learning so far amid coronavirus restrictions. Three new Hanover County School educators are with us today and answering your questions. Delia Herman is a Hoggard High School teacher. Tim Jarman teaches at Ashley High School. Lena Varnum is a teacher and an instructional coach at Williston Middle School. Tell us about your experience and your children's learning experience during this pandemic. Or you can ask our teachers a question during this live discussion on Wednesday, June 3rd. Send an email to coastline@whqr.org. This is the last segment, so just a few minutes left to get your question or comment in. And Delia, just before we went to break, you were explaining some of the tools that you chose to use.
I went with the flipped classroom approach instead of the Zoom. I pre-recorded my lessons and then I made myself very available office hours. You could email me. With technology and Google apps, I can get students' comments immediately and respond pretty quickly. So I decided not to use the Zoom. I got only positive feedback from my students about that. They were grateful that I didn't make them show up for Zoom classes. But any negative feedback, nobody said, I wish you did Zoom. Although I might do it a little differently if I tried it again. But I just like the idea of being able to pause a lesson, do it when you want, rewind it, rewatch it. It's something I've always wanted to try. And this kind of forced me out of my comfort zone to try something that I had wanted to try in the past. And I think a lot of teachers had to do that. And in the end, I think it will benefit everyone. And I just want to say that I'm really proud of all the teachers because I think everybody rose to the occasion.
Agreed.
Yeah. And Delia, of course, you teach high school, and Lena Varnum, you're at a middle school. Do you think that there is a difference in how well middle school students can handle the flexibility of, for instance, not needing to show up at a certain time for class, but still get their work done? What's your experience with that?
I think there's certainly a difference. I did teach high school in the beginning of my career for a few years, and I think there's definitely a difference. I think that our middle school students probably needed a lot more guidance and intervention from their parents when that was available to them. The high school students, I hope, were a little more self-directed and motivated. We see that in middle school anyway, that once students get to eighth grade or as they go on to high school, they start to be motivated by what comes after high school, by college, by work, and how they want to shape their lives. And that's a lot harder for middle school students, and that's developmentally appropriate for middle school students. And so I think that, you know, at my school, a lot of teachers chose to use Zoom and a lot of teachers chose not to use Zoom. And I think that people were successful in both ways. But I have heard a lot of positive feedback from students about having Zoom calls with their classes. I also have two children of my own, and my son had Zoom calls, and I know my daughter was jealous of him when he did his Zoom calls, because she wanted to see her classmates. And I think that social piece of having a Zoom meeting with your class is important to students too.
Yeah. So Grace writes, I'm curious about the different ideas that have been discussed about what the next school year may look like for students and teachers. Will remote learning be in place? Hand washing stations, masks for students and teachers? I can imagine expecting students to socially distance will be a huge, if not impossible, challenge for the schools, as it has been a huge challenge as a mother. So Tim Jarman, what do we know, first of all, about when schools are going to open for the next academic year, and then take it from there?
Cool. Thank you. As of now, traditional schools will be starting on August 17th. What the details of our day-to-day or what school will look like, we don't have a definitive answer. And so I do feel that it's probably best for me, especially as a member of the calendar committee, to wait before I give any more information, because we're all navigating kind of this uncertainty as policymakers, as teachers, as citizens. And I don't want to add to any of that confusion right now. But all I know is that as of now, our traditional schools will be starting on August 17th.
Okay, so those details like distancing and hand washing and meals, if they'll be in the cafeteria or nobody really knows that yet. It's kind of a moving target.
Nobody knows, to my understanding, but it's something that I, as a teacher, as a parent, like I'm very interested in as a citizen. I mean, these are things that I've been thinking about a lot, and I would really like to know more information about this. And I understand if there's people in the public who want to know that too, because it's a big deal, and it's this is going to be a lot to navigate moving forward.
Yeah. Lena Varnum, what role do social workers or counselors play, or what role will they need to play as we develop this new way of functioning? Because even if we do go back to school in the traditional sense, it's likely this is going to come up again for one reason or another.
Absolutely. Thank you. I think that's a great question. Our social workers and counselors have been so important to being able to contact our students, remaining abreast of what their needs are, what the families' needs are. Families access a lot of their social services through schools. And so having buildings closed can be really difficult. I will say that at Williston, I know that our counselors and social workers worked tirelessly to continue to support students. who they knew had needs. And we are fortunate at Williston to also have a mental health therapist, and he continued to provide therapy to students that he had already been working with in a remote way. So those things we were very happy to be able to do. But we also know that the social emotional health of our students is going to be a huge concern when we return, and even during this time. One of the things that Williston has been doing is spending a lot of time looking at some of our data that we get from a program called EYES that we participate in along with four other middle schools in the county. And we have really great data that can help us target our social and emotional teaching and services for our students. And so during this time, we have been trying to leverage that as much as we can in providing support to students now, but also getting ready to provide support to students as they return to school buildings, whatever that may look like in the fall.
So obviously there are going to be degrees of need, and a lot of that probably has to do with the kind of stability that a child has in the home or doesn't have. But what kinds of mental health issues and emotional issues do you expect, and this is for all of you, what do you expect to have to deal with when school comes back one way or another? Is there any way that you can prepare for it, not being social workers yourselves, although I guess just being a teacher, that's required in a lot of settings. Delia Herman?
Well, as an English teacher, we get to read a lot of times, we get to hear about what students are feeling and thinking. And I did notice it became a little troubling towards the end. You could feel the isolation the students were feeling. They were upset that they didn't get to see their friends all the time. Some of them enjoyed it. There were more introverted students who said, I didn't mind it too much. But there were some who, like, I end up referring them to their counselors when I see things that are kind of make me a little concerned for them. So I'm not a counselor or a social worker. I usually just defer to those people when I see something that causes me concern.
Yeah.
I do know that the counselor did respond to one of my emails saying he was concerned about the impact this is having on students.
Yeah. Tim Jarman, what kinds of emotional impacts do you think will be visible when students come back into your class?
Like I said, I teach right now majority of AP courses. And when the students come back, a lot of focus is, what is college going to look like? How is this going to affect college admissions process? Am I prepared for college? Did I get enough meaningful instruction when this time was off, and so on and so forth? But in general, just the anxiety of, will this happen again? Could this happen again? What's tomorrow going to look like? What's, you know, the rest of the day going to look like? There's just so much uncertainty that all these students have had to deal with that I think it's always going to be in their conscience. And it's a lot to carry for them, and it's a lot to carry for us as well. And so addressing those different anxieties the students might have. Will there ever be sports again? I mean, there's just so much uncertainty with all the students in so many different ways.
Lena Varnum, you talked about how some social workers in Williston Middle School are reaching out to families. Are there any families that they just haven't been able to connect to? I mean, has anybody had the experience of just being ghosted by an entire family?
Well, at Williston, I know that we have been able to contact all of our families. I know that some other schools I've heard have not had that much success. I think it really depends on the school. But we were able to contact all of our students, but in some cases that meant that we contacted them once. And then after that, maybe we were a little bit ghosted, because I think it was overwhelming a little bit for families, because we were really making an effort to reach out and to call. And throughout the time out of school at Williston, we've attempted to contact every family every week. And we need to stay in touch with our students. But it is a little bit overwhelming. I felt that myself as a parent. I received lots of communication from my children's school, lots of phone calls and emails, and it became a little bit difficult to keep up with. And so I think that's where we saw some families check out a little bit, because we had the stress and the trauma of the spreading virus, of, you know, all the closures in society. It was difficult. And then on top of that, families are juggling, trying to manage the schooling for their children. And that's really tough.
Delia Herman, you actually asked your students to write some reflections on their experience. We just have a couple of minutes left, but could you read some of one of them?
Yeah, this would have fit back when we were talking about the challenges these students were facing. One of my students said, "I learned quickly that I needed to get up at a decent time to have any motivation for the day. I set my alarm for 8:30 every day so I would have an hour before my siblings got up and started making noise. I realized I needed a quiet space and few distractions to do my work successfully. That was harder to find than you would think. When my siblings went on Zoom calls, they were loud and they lasted at least an hour at a time. It was hard not to be frustrated, but there was nothing I could do but wait. And whenever I had my phone on hand, I ended up using it for non-school related things. Then there was the internet problem. We couldn't have more than two people on Zoom calls at one time. And then my old Chromebook from middle school couldn't hold a connection for more than 15 minutes. I used my mom's computer whenever she wasn't busy, but she was usually using it for work." And I want to point out that this is a student who had access to plenty of resources and still had a struggle.
Yeah. So when you think about lessons learned so far from where you sit, is there any silver lining in what's happened here? And is there anything that you're happy you were kind of forced into so you can take that no matter what the future looks like? Delia, I see you nodding. What are you?
Yeah, because when we were in the thick of it, I was thinking, but I also want to say that there's been good things about this. I think for a lot of the teachers who've been resistant to try new things and to try technology, a lot of these technology resources are helpful for students, like Edpuzzle, which allows you to upload a flipped lesson video. You can ask questions along the way. Again, students can watch at their own pace, rewind, review, and teachers stepped up to the challenge on that. And just speaking for as an introvert myself, I noticed with my introverted students, some of them thrived at home. I got work out of them I never got in the classroom. They had the space and time to think. And so it was cool to see some students thrive online at home. Not everybody struggled the whole time.
Tim Jarman, any silver lining for you?
I mean, like Delia said, when it came to the introverts, I had students who I couldn't connect with in school and who absolutely thrived with virtual learning, dominated the digital chat. It was a really interesting experience. And I, as well with trying new things myself as a teacher and watching my colleagues do that too. You know, learning takes effort, and things have been difficult. Things have been in flux, but this is kind of a moment where learning's more important than ever. All the effort we're putting towards learning new things to help students, to help ourselves, I mean, we're being helpful through our learning. And it's just, even though things are challenging and difficult, there's so much value in learning during this time. And the experiences that I had were on the whole pretty positive.
And that's this edition of Coastline. Lena Varnum, Delia Herman, Tim Jarman, thank you all so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Rachel Keith is the producer of Coastline. Ken Campbell is technical director. Coastline is a production of WHQR Public Media. If you missed part of this episode, look for it at whqr.org, get the podcast, or find it on the HQR app. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.